Hey everyone, welcome back. It is Dead Obsessed's first episode back from hiatus. I am Ashley, if you didn't already know, and it's just good to be back, although it is a bit weird. I feel like I'm starting podcasting from scratch, with the exception that I have a fancy microphone. I feel like I've got just some weird awkwardness about me, I guess, because this is a solo episode and I'm by myself. I'm just kind of talking at the little waveform on my computer. So I apologize in advance if I sound weird, if I sound awkward, if maybe the audio is not quite what you're used to, but I am trying my best. Anyway, this is, like I said, the first episode back from hiatus, and this episode's subject matter is something that I fell down a rabbit hole with during hiatus. It's something that, as an Australian, or as I guess not American, I knew little to nothing about, and I'll get into that in more detail later, but this is the story of Abraham Lincoln, his assassination, and the story of John Wilkes Booth. So I'll just jump right into it, and I'm going to open with a quote. "Now, by God, I'll put him through. That is the last speech he will ever make." These are the famous words that sealed the deal on one of the most famous murders in the world, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. As many of you know, and if you didn't know, and you for some reason cannot tell, I'm Australian. I know a lot. Well, no, that's a lie. I don't know a lot of Lincoln. I know of Lincoln. I know the absolute basics. Beard, cheekbones, stovepipe hat, the abolition of slavery, and of course, his assassination. But until recently, I didn't know the details. Like any of them. I apologize to the American listeners because you probably know all about it, but here we go. Abraham Lincoln is born February 12, 1809, on a poor farm in Kentucky to parents Thomas Lincoln and Nancy Hanks Lincoln. At age 7, the Lincoln family moved from Kentucky to Indiana. Indiana was a free territory, meaning it was illegal to have enslaved people in that state, although that didn't always stop people, and an enslaved person that entered that state was not necessarily made free by simply entering. Lincoln's parents are members of a separatist Baptist church that forbade alcohol, dancing, and slavery. Which, cool on the forbidden slavery count, but dancing? Yeesh. I also wonder on their reasonings for opposing slavery. Let's hope it's because slavery is pure evil and not some backwards association thing. When Abraham is 9 years old, his mother dies of milk sickness, which is a type of poisoning where the cow eats a poisonous plant and it gets into the milk it produces. This leaves Abraham's 11-year-old sister Sarah to manage a household consisting of Thomas, Abraham's dad, Abraham, and their cousin Dennis, who was 19 years old and a recent orphan. A year later, Thomas Lincoln remarries and their family welcomes Sarah Johnston and her 3 children. So there's stepmom Sarah and sister Sarah. Stepmom Sarah, who Abraham eventually came to call mother, would remark later on that Abraham did not enjoy the physical labours of farm work and that the family would regard him as lazy because of his preference to reading and writing over working on the farm. Same. Abraham is mostly self-taught in the world of education. By 15, he undertakes roughly 12 months of schooling in total from a mix of itinerant teachers, kind of like travelling tutors, and formal schooling interrupted by farm work. By 21, he becomes a wrestling champion for his county and gains a decent reputation after defeating the local ruffian gang leader in a match. I will never be free of the image of adult Lincoln in all his lankiness in a modern day wrestling outfit. Anyway, in 1830, Abraham and several of his family move to Illinois, another free state, where he takes to his own, separate from his father, and moves to New Salem, where he meets his first girlfriend, Anne Rutledge. In 1832, Abraham serves, although he sees no combat, in the Black Hawk War, a war which lasts 21 days between white settlers and Native Americans, resulting in the death of 450 to 600 Native Americans, the number is debated, which was roughly half of their force, and 77 white settlers. After this war, Abraham actually becomes a bartender and co-owner of a local tavern, which eventually goes into debt as his partner becomes an alcoholic and drinks all of their merchandise. In 1832, he enters the world of politics and runs for the Illinois General Assembly, but loses. I barely know much about Australian politics and how they work, let alone American, so I will, with 100% certainty, butcher this, if not just skip most of it, because I genuinely hate politics. It's complicated, and this was over 100 years ago, so it's all over the place for me in my brain anyway. In 1835, while Abraham is serving in the Illinois House of Representatives for Sangamon County, his girlfriend Anne Rutledge dies before they can become formally engaged. During his terms, Abraham adopts a free soil stance, opposing both slavery and abolition. Basically, he's against slavery as a whole, yay, but also is aware that people don't like change and getting rid of it in one go was thought to be impossible, so he's more vocal about being against the expansion of slavery than being vocal about getting rid of it as a whole. Make sense? In 1836, Abraham is admitted to the Illinois bar where he would be a practicing lawyer for around 25 years. At the same time as his bar admittance, his second girlfriend, Mary Owens, lasts about a year before he wrote to her saying he wouldn't blame her if she ended the relationship, and she never replied to him. So if you ever feel bad about being ghosted, just remember, it happened to Lincoln too. Eventually, after a cancelled wedding and courting for a year, Abraham married Mary Todd in 1839. The couple would go on to have four sons, but only one would live to adulthood. The first, Robert, was born in 1843. The second son, Edward, was born in 1846. Edward dies in 1850 at the age of four, and the third son, Willie, was born December of that year. The fourth son is born in 1853, and his name Thomas. Please see my earlier statement about likely skipping a lot of the political details. On the 6th of November, 1860, Abraham Lincoln is elected president. I told you I was going to skip him. February 8th, 1861, the Confederacy is formed. Now, we all at least kind of know these bits. There's a war, there are famous speeches, a lot of military things happen, and I'm sure me glossing over this will enrage a few people. I get it is very important history, I do, but that isn't the story I'm trying to tell right now. In February 1862, at the age of 12, Abraham's third son, Willie, dies, and jumping ahead to 1871, at age 18, Thomas would also die, but Abraham would not be alive to witness the passing of his youngest son, and eventually the couple's only surviving son, Robert, would have to commit his mother, his last living immediate family member, to an asylum in 1875 for a time because of the tragedies. Now, on September 22nd, 1862, during the second year of the Civil War, Abraham issued the Preliminary Emancipation Proclamation, but the Civil War wouldn't end until April 9th, 1865, and just a few days later, Abraham Lincoln would be dead. His killer? John Wilkes Booth. John Wilkes Booth was born May 10th, 1838, to noted Shakespearean actor Junius Booth, I think it's Junius, and Mary Ann Holmes. The pair had immigrated from the UK in 1821. Booth was the ninth of 10 children. I wonder if that counts as him being a middle child. Like, I mean, 5 and 6 are technically the middle, or maybe we can rename it second to last child syndrome. Anyway, Booth went to the Bel Air Academy, a school in Maryland that actually still operates. He was described as intelligent, but disinterested in formal learning. In 1850-51, he attended a Quaker-run boarding school for boys called Milton's, where at some point he met a fortune teller who foretold he would have a grand but short life, doomed to die young and meet a bad end, which apparently he wrote down word for word and would show people. Booth then attended an Episcopal military academy called St. Timothy's that prided itself on daily drills and strict discipline. Now, Booth's parents weren't married until he was 13 because his mother, Mary Ann, was actually Junius's mistress. The couple married in 1851, the same year Junius's wife was granted a divorce. They got married on Booth's 13th birthday. I guess when there are 12 birthdays in the family plus holidays, choosing a good wedding date is hard? I don't know. The next year, Booth's father would die and Booth would drop out of school. At age 16, he began exploring his interests in both acting and politics. He involved himself in local political parties and began to follow his father's and two of his brother's footsteps by practicing elocution and studying Shakespeare. At age 17 in 1855, Booth made his acting debut in a supporting role in Richard III, where he was mocked for forgetting some of his lines in the show. He went by J.B. Wilkes on stage to avoid being compared to his famous father and brothers. He performed in a number of local theatres and joined a stock company and was able to perform for an entire season. Booth was described as an outrageous scene stealer, but he played his parts with such heightened enthusiasm that the audiences idolised him. Booth gained a reputation for being exceedingly handsome, lively, funny, and strong. By the end of the 1850s, Booth was earning roughly $20,000 a year, which is about $684,000 US, which is approximately $906,000 Australian. Jesus fuck. In 1859, Booth borrowed, i.e. stole, a uniform from a volunteer militia in order to get as close as possible to the hanging of John Brown, an abolitionist leader. Booth stood with others from the Richmond Greys to stop any sort of rescue attempt. The hanging was without incident. In the 1860s, Booth gained more fame and more popularity. He performed in many large cities like New York, Boston, Chicago, New Orleans, and more. He was described as having monumental natural genius. Booth even performed in front of Abraham Lincoln in the Ford Theatre, where he delivered a line of dialogue quite sternly and seemingly directly at him. According to his sister, Booth would smuggle anti-malarial drugs through the Norse blockade to aid the South during his travels for performances. In the first half of 1863, Booth was arrested, charged, fined, and then released for making treasonous remarks against the government and Abraham Lincoln. The remarks were along the lines of him wishing, and I quote, "the president and the whole damn government would go to hell," which seems a bit extreme to charge him for that compared to what we say nowadays, but go off, I guess. Upon his release, he had to swear an oath of allegiance to the Union, which obviously worked super well. In the same decade, Booth would invest his growing wealth in all sorts of businesses, including becoming an investor in oil lands. His investment was around $6,000 in 1864, or $108,000 US, or $143,000 Australian now. Booth would let go of this investment and essentially all things going for him in 1864 when his obsession with the Civil War and hatred of abolitionists would take over. It would be during Abraham's re-election campaign that Booth would become more enraged at the president and blame him almost entirely for the war and the troubles in the South. Booth would blame him so much so that he would devise a plot to kidnap Abraham as to ransom the president for Confederate soldiers kept as prisoners and hoping to force the Union government to recognize the Confederacy as its own government. Booth's plan was to wait until Abraham was at his summer residence, known as the Old Soldiers' Home, which was about 3 miles, or 4.8 kilometers for anyone not American, from the White House. Once Booth had the president, he wanted to smuggle him across the Potomac River, not quite sure how he planned to do that exactly, and into Richmond, Virginia. The Confederate Army was known to have smugglers for recruits and supplies and messages across the river, but personally I feel like smuggling the president and the leader of the Union, who stood at 6'4" no less, and everyone knew his face, would be some pretty hard to hide cargo. Booth assembled a group of companions to help him in his plan that on March 17th the president would be at a play in a hospital near the soldiers' home and that the kidnapping would happen en route to the performance. Before the date of the kidnapping had arrived, Booth actually attended the second inauguration of Lincoln. He was the guest of Lucy Hale, the daughter of US Senator John P. Hale, as the couple was secretly engaged. On the day of the planned kidnapping, March 17th, Booth's team lined one of the roads that Lincoln should take between the Old Soldiers' Home and the destined hospital. Booth and his team waited, and waited, but the president did not appear. Instead, it turned out at the last minute that the president had changed his plans and instead attended a reception at the National Hotel in Washington, the exact location that Booth himself was residing in at the time. It would be less than a month later, with the news that Robert E. Lee had surrendered himself, that Booth would decide kidnapping the president would not be enough to make the statement he wanted for the Confederacy, that the only option now was assassination. April 14th, 1865, Booth attends Ford's Theatre to gather his mail. During this errand, he is told that both the president and Ulysses S. Grant and their wives would be attending the current performance, Our American Cousin. Immediately, Booth arranged an escape route and acquired a getaway horse. The plan was set into motion that not only would Booth kill President Lincoln and Ulysses S. Grant that night, but that his accomplices would also assassinate Secretary of State William Seward and Vice President Andrew Johnson to completely behead the Union government. Only one of the attacks would be successful. William Stewart was already bedridden from a carriage accident he had been involved in and was stabbed and wounded but not killed by Lewis Powell, and the attack on VP Andrew Johnson didn't happen at all, as George Azarot spent the night instead chasing his courage at the bottom of a bottle, i.e. he chickened out and went to the bar instead. The first act of the play came and went. Lincoln sits in his box with his wife and Major Henry Rathbone and his fiancée. Ulysses Grant and his wife changed their minds and had gone instead to visit a family in New Jersey. And during intermission, Booth resided in the saloon. At about 10 past 10 p.m., Booth entered the theatre and made his way up the stairs to the president's box. He passed by a handful of people, none of whom stopped or even approached him. Remember, he is a famous actor, and of course he's around the theatre. Not unusual at all. At 10:14 p.m., Booth slides his way into the president's box, holds the .41 caliber single-shot pistol approximately 4 to 6 inches from the back of Abraham Lincoln's head, and pulls the trigger. As Booth attempts his escape, he is grabbed by Henry Rathbone, who is in turn stabbed by Booth before he manages to jump from the president's box onto the stage before raising his knife and declaring "Sic semper tyrannis," the same words said to have been said by Brutus when he killed Caesar. It is Latin for "thus always to tyrants." From the alley behind the theatre, Booth and David Herold rode south through the Zika swamp onto Surratt's Tavern, where the group had hidden guns and equipment for the original kidnapping plot. The pair stopped the next morning at a doctor's home in St. Catherine to treat an injury to Booth's leg, whose horse had apparently fallen on him. A few hours after Booth and Herold made it to the doctor's house, President Lincoln officially died at 7:22 a.m. on the 15th of April on the bed of William Peterson, who lived just across from the theatre. From the doctors in St. Catherine, the pair moved from the home of Samuel Cox, who was closer to the river. Cox had a foster brother who was a high-up Confederate spy agent. At this point, the Department of War arranged troops to search for Booth and also issue a $100,000 reward, which is $3.3 million in US, which is a whopping $4.4 million Australian today. Once again, I say, Jesus, fuck. For the next 5 days, Booth would be hiding in the woods waiting to cross the Potomac. Over those days, he read newspapers and found almost no support for his actions, even in papers that used to basically be Lincoln hate mail. Once night fell, the pair were provided a boat and a compass to cross the river. Somehow they fucked up and ended up upriver to a bend and got out back in Maryland instead of Virginia. Harold happened to know the area quite well from previous hunting trips, and they made their way to a Confederate sympathizer's farm. The farmer took them to his son, a Confederate colonel, who gave them food and shelter until they had the cover of darkness to attempt to row across again. Dawn, April 23rd, they reached Maryland. They contacted Thomas Harbin, who was originally in on the kidnapping, who took them to someone else who provided them with horses. From here, the pair crossed the Rappahannock River. I did not check that pronunciation, I am sorry. Led by William Jett. They arrived at the farm of H. Garrett and his family. Booth was introduced as James Boyd, an injured Confederate soldier on his way home. During their stay at the Garrett's farm, a division of Union troops were on their way to search for Booth in Virginia. Eventually, they caught up to Jett and interrogated him. Jett relinquished the location where the pair were. The troops approached the farm and surrounded the tobacco barn where the fugitives were hiding inside. David Herold surrendered, but Booth refused, seemingly thinking there was more dignity in fighting than surrendering. But rather than fight, the soldiers set the barn on fire, which I think is incredibly rude. Like, this isn't like government property, it's like a family's livelihood. And they didn't know who he was. That just pissed me off a little. Like, y'all had guns and nearly 30 of you, but you set the building on fire rather than surround him or go in and wait him out. Anyway, they set the barn on fire. Rude. And then while Booth is looking for a way out, he's shot in the neck by a Sergeant Corbett, who claimed it was in response to Booth raising his pistol, but his commander reported it was without order or excuse. Booth was paralyzed from the shot and dragged from the barn to the porch, where it took him 3 hours to finally die. His last words while looking at his hands that had been moved for him to see were, "Useless, useless." And he died. Or did he? The reason I chose this specific case was because I learned some weird stories surrounding John Wilkes Booth's death. The death I just told you about is the official story. He was shot. He died. His body taken aboard to a Navy ship for autopsy, which, that's weird, right? Identified by at least 10 people, again, that's weird, right? As well as a tattoo of his own initials, questionable taste, and a scar on his neck. Booth was then apparently stored for 2 years before being released and buried in his family plot in Baltimore. But there are others that think Booth escaped. The origin of this theory? A deathbed confession. Or two. John St. Helen lived in Granbury, Texas. He was a bartender, had a theatrical personality, and could recite much Shakespeare from memory. In 1878, he became very ill, to the point he thought he would die. And in his fear of death, he confessed to his friend Phineas Bates that he wasn't John St. Helen, but in fact that he was John Wilkes Booth. I am dying. My name is John Wilkes Booth, and I am the assassin of President Lincoln. Get the picture of myself from under the pillow. I leave it with you for my future identification. Notify my brother Edwin Booth of New York City. But St. Helen didn't die. He recovered and decided to elaborate on his confession. That the man they killed in Booth's place in the tobacco barn was simply a stand-in, a man by the name of Rudy St. Helen, who Booth asked to fetch his belongings from their boat that he had dropped, and that when the troops arrived, Rudy was simply mistaken for Booth, and the possession of his items was a wrong place, wrong time, wrong stuff mishap, and that the assassination and his escape was facilitated by Lincoln's VP, Andrew Johnson. Not long after the confession and subsequent recovery, John St. Helen moved, and Phineas Bates wrote a book. The second confession came from David E. George, a house painter with a habit of quoting Shakespeare. January 1903, Booth would have been 65, David George went to his local drugstore in Enid, Oklahoma, and bought strychnine. He told the cashier that he wanted to poison a dog. Just quickly, I have several things I want to say. One, it's wild that you could just over-the-counter at a pharmacy buy poison. And two, it's also wild and horrible that you can do that to poison a dog. Not long after the purchase, David went back to the pharmacy, spoke to a different man, this time the owner, and bought more strychnine. This time he claimed it was to poison a cat. Seriously? Anyway. By 10:30 that morning, the tenants of the Grand Avenue Hotel where George was staying complained of odd noises coming from his room. They broke in to find George dying. He had ingested the poison himself, and within half an hour, he was dead. After his death, the now wife of a local minister had confided in her husband that a few years back, David George had confessed to her that he was John Wilkes Booth and that he had, quote, killed the greatest man that ever lived. The minister's wife wrote it off as George being high and delirious. David George's body was unclaimed after death and instead sat tied to a chair on display with his eyes open and a newspaper in his hands at the funeral home. It is reported that thousands of people viewed the body, with some taking hair, buttons, and one report of a man trying to cut off an ear. Eventually, the same Phineas Bates that knew John St. Helen claimed the body of George. In 1920, William Evans, a man known as the Carnival King, rented the mummified body from Bates, and in 1923, when Bates died, his widow sold the remains to Evans. The body was then, over the years, passed between owners going or study, in hard air quotes, because there was nothing conclusive ever discovered. In the 1950s, the mummy nicknamed John was stolen from a home in Philadelphia, with the last reported sighting of it was at a Midwestern carnival in the 70s. In 2010, descendants of Edwin Booth, John's brother, obtained permission for the interred remains of Edwin to be exhumed and tested against the vertebrae labelled as John Wilkes Booth held in the National Museum of Health and Medicine to confirm that John Wilkes Booth did die in April of 1865 and that he did not, in fact, escape. The museum denied the request. This episode of Dead Obsessed was researched, written, and edited by me, Ash Rose. Come and join me on Instagram at deadobsessedpodcast or write to us at deadobsessedpod@gmail.com. I'll catch you soon and stay obsessed. I don't like that. I don't like how he did that. That's not what that says, even at all. It says reputation. Slavery. Wow. Jesus fuck.